Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 82.
So it kicks off with Pigsy, our often, let's say, enthusiastic friend. He's scouting ahead and spots two female monsters.
Yeah, just drawing water from a well. Seems pretty normal on the surface.
Totally innocuous. But then Pigsy, in his classic style, completely fumbles the whole thing. No hello, no nothing. He just instantly yells, monsters, at them.
You could almost hear the needle scratch off the record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk about zero social grace.
Right. And their reaction, predictable, maybe?
Oh, absolutely furious.
Yeah.
The text says they were, like, incandescent. They basically say, who is this lazy, brazen monk? We don't know him. How dare he call us monsters?
So they weren't aggressive initially. He provoked them.
And completely. His rudeness was the trigger. So they grab their water-carrying poles and just start whacking him.
Ouch.
Yeah, forces him to run back up the mountain, tail between his legs, so to speak.
And naturally, he goes back complaining to Monkey King, right?
Yeah.
Whining about how fierce they were.
Yep. Even shows off, like bumps and bruises, saying they hit him 3 or 4 times. Classic Pigsy deflection.
But Monkey King isn't buying it.
Not for a second. He's sharp. He doesn't blame the monsters. He immediately zeroes in on Pigsy's approach. Says it was his fault.
He even says something like, you got off lightly.
He does. And then he drops this really profound line. People prioritize propriety.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, politeness and good conduct are fundamental.
That sounds kind of poetic for Monkey King, especially mid-crisis.
And then he gives this brilliant analogy to drive it home.
Ah, the wood analogy.
Exactly. Two types of wood. First, poplar wood yangmu. It's soft.
Right, so craftsmen can easily carve it into statues of Buddhas, saints.
Mm-hmm. And those statues get covered in gold, jewels, worshipped by millions, receive blessings, all because of his gentle nature.
Okay, so that's the soft wood. What's the other one?
Sandalwood. Tanmu. Hard. Rigid. Stubborn.
And what happens to it?
Because it's so hard, it gets taken to oil mills, used as a press, bound with iron hoops, hammered constantly.
Mm-hmm.
It suffers, basically, precisely because of its hardness.
Wow. That's a powerful image. Gentle gets worshipped, hard gets hammered.
Pretty much. And Monkey King spells it out.
Yeah.
Gentle and soft can go anywhere in the world, while rigid and strong cannot move an inch.
Okay, I get the principle, but how does that actually work when you're facing, you know, actual monsters trying to beat you with poles? Isn't strength needed sometimes?
Well, that's the crucial insight, isn't it? Soft here isn't about being weak, it's strategic. It's about adaptability. Rigidity just smashes against obstacles. Gentleness can, like, flow around them.
So Pigsy's initial monster's approach was the rigid sandalwood.
Exactly. Created a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Monkey King is saying a softer approach, politeness, can actually open doors, even with enemies. It's about finding a way in.
So, okay, lesson learned, or at least delivered. Monkey King switches tactics. Brute force failed. What's plan B? Information needed. Right.
Right. They need to know if the master, Tripitaka, is actually down there. So the new plan involves Pigsy transforming.
Uh-oh.
And this time, using polite inquiry. Monkey's instructions are super specific.
Like what?
Transform. Approach respectfully. Greet them as Miss Gunyang, if they seem about his age, or Grandma Nainai, if they look older.
Grandma.
The goal, explicitly, is to pump them for information, ta-ta hua. Find out about the master.
And Pigsy actually does it. He transforms into, what was it, a fat black monk.
Yep, that's the description. Quite the disguise. Mm-hmm. And the interaction is, well, it's pretty funny.
Oh.
See, he's down, bows respectfully, calls him Grandma, and they're actually pleased. They say something like, oh, this monk's quite good, knows how to bow. Politeness works. Initially.
Okay, step one, success. Then
it gets awkward. They ask him, Elder, where'd you come from? And Pigsy just repeats the question back at them.
Wait, what? As his answer.
Yeah, and then they ask, where are you going? Same thing. What is your name? And he just parrots them.
Oh my gosh. So the monsters must think he's...
witless, as the word used. Polite, yes, but seems to only be able to repeat things, like he has no mind of his own.
Hilarious. But did it work? Did he get the info?
Well, here's the irony. Despite being utterly terrible at conversation, his politeness did keep the door open. It's such a contrast to his first attempt. Being nice, even awkwardly, got him further than being aggressive.
It really shows how just changing your demeanor, even if you're clumsy, can make a huge difference. Aggression failed. Awkward politeness gets a hearing.
Exactly. It wasn't about being clever, just about not being rude this time.
So Pigsy finally stops parroting and asks his real question.
He does. He eventually asks, Grandma, why are you two drawing water? Finally getting to the point.
And this is where the big reveal happens.
Bingo. The monsters spill the beans.
Yeah.
They say their old madam has captured Tripitaka. He's in their cave.
Wow. Okay, confirmed. But what about the water? You mentioned something specific.
Ah, yes, the yin-yang intercourse water. Sounds ominous, right?
Definitely. What's that about?
They explain their cave water isn't clean enough, so they need this special water for a vegetarian feast they're preparing.
A feast for Tripitaka. That sounds slightly less threatening. Maybe.
You'd think. But then they drop the real bombshell. The feast is happening that evening and right after. The old madam intends to marry Tripitaka.
Marry him. Marry Tripitaka, the monk, to a demoness.
That's the plan. Talk about a plot twist.
I cannot imagine Pigsy hearing that. What does he do?
His reaction is pure gold. Pure Pigsy. He bolts back up the mountain frantic, shouting at Monkey and Sandy to, like, divide up the luggage.
Divide the luggage. Why?
Because, he yells, they should all just go their separate ways. The quest is over. Why? The master is already married to the demon. He's completely given up.
Oh, Pigsy. Always jumping to conclusions. What does Monkey King say to that?
Monkey King is, thankfully, the calm center. He just dismisses it as nonsense, tells Pigsy to stop talking rubbish. The master is trapped, waiting for rescue, not on his honeymoon.
Right. Panic versus strategy.
Exactly. The information, however shocking, leads Monkey King to immediate, focused action. No time for despair.
So what's the new plan? Now they know about the marriage plot.
Decisive action. Monkey King lays it out. Pigsy and Sandy, you take the horse, carry the luggage. Monkey King himself will follow those two female monsters.
Use them as a guide.
As a lure is the term used in Yinzi. Follow them right to the cave entrance, then launch a coordinated attack. Use their own servants against them.
Clever. So they follow them.
They do. The trio tracks the two monsters deeper into the mountains, maybe 10, 20, a fair distance.
Okay, closing in.
But then suddenly, poof, the monsters just vanish. Gone without a trace.
Vanish, like thin air.
Just disappeared.
And let me guess Pigsy's reaction.
You got it.
Ah.
True to form, Pigsy immediately jumps to the supernatural. He cries out that the master must have been snatched by day ghosts.
Day ghosts?
Yeah, he figures the monsters were these day ghosts and they just dematerialized.
But Monkey King, he's not buying the ghost theory.
Nope. His mind works differently. He instantly deduces they didn't just vanish. They must have entered a hidden cave entrance right there.
Logical explanation over superstition.
Exactly. His immediate thought is, find the hidden door. Investigate. No time wasted on ghosts when there's a physical explanation. They find the demon's place. It was starts pretty impressively, base of a cliff, and there's this amazing archway, really ornate, described as a dong, jom, as a joden, just intricate.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully detailed.
And carved right on it, six big characters.
Tiang Kong Mountain, bottomless cave.
I mean, talk about an entrance, grand, kind of ominous, sets a mood, right?
It really does. And, you know, these grand entrances in stories like this, they often signal something big, maybe hidden danger or maybe a really profound challenge just beyond it. So that archway immediately gives you that feeling of grandeur, but also maybe dread. Something significant is definitely going on.
Right. But then here's the first twist. Despite this huge archway, this dramatic name, Bottomless Cave, the actual way in, it's tiny. The text calls it a cylinder mouth sized hole. Just a small opening in this massive smooth of stone that's apparently 10 length around, like 5 kilometers in circumference.
Yeah, that's quite the contrast, isn't it?
Totally. Okay, let's unpack this. That's not what you'd expect, is it?
Not at all. And what's fascinating here is exactly that contrast. You've got the showy, ornate archway on the outside, and then this like humble, almost hidden little hole. It suggests something, doesn't it? Maybe the demon's way of getting in and out, or maybe something about her hidden nature. Deception right from the start.
And Wukong, you know, he doesn't waste time. He uses his fiery golden eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Love that detail to check out the pit. And the depth he sees, it's just staggering. Straight down.
Wow.
You can totally see why Pigsy's like, nope. He jokes, kind of, that if he fell, he wouldn't hit bottom for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, can you blame him?
Not really. It just paints such a vivid picture, doesn't it? The sheer scale of this thing they're facing. How do you even deal with that?
Exactly, it's immense.
So Wukong, ever the strategist, figures out a plan. Or a plan, anyway. He calls it a pincer movement. Tells Pigsy and Sandy, okay, you guys guard the entrance up here. Meanwhile, he's going in alone to fight the demon and, like, flush her out.
Hmm. Now, this raises an important question, doesn't it? What does this tell us about how Wukong sees this demon? Is he going in alone because he thinks she's that powerful and he needs to scout first? Or is it just his confidence, his strategic mind, realizing only he can handle that crazy drop?
Good question. Maybe a bit of both. It definitely suggests she's not just some minor obstacle.
Right, a serious threat.
So Wukong takes the leap, jumps into the pit, and here's where it gets really interesting. He's expecting, you know, darkness, maybe slime, horrors. It's called the bottomless pit, after all.
Uh-huh. Standard demon lair stuff.
No. The source says inside it's bright and clear. There's sunlight, wind, even flowers, grass, fruit trees, the works.
Seriously, down there. Seriously.
Yeah.
Wukong himself is stunned. He's actually delighted. Compares it favorably to his own home, the Water Curtain Cave. Calls it a heavenly blessed land or some pit of D.
Wow. Okay, so if we connect this to the bigger picture, this completely flips the script, right? A bottomless cave that's like a paradise inside. It suggests this demon has some serious power, maybe something unique. It's not just a cave, it's a hidden realm almost.
Adds a whole other layer to her, doesn't it? Deceptive on the outside, beautiful on the inside, but still dangerous.
Exactly. Much more complex.
Okay, so Wukong's confirmed the lair is weird. Next move. Classic Wukong transforms, shrinks down into a tiny fly to sneak into her actual living quarters, which turn out to be quite civilized. A two-eave gate tower, pine trees, bamboo, lots of rooms.
Very sneaky, very Monkey King.
And inside, he gets a good look at the demoness and the description.
Oh, wow.
It's incredibly detailed. Says she's even more beautiful than he remembered. We get things like hair, like piled crows, a green velvet flowery vest, golden lotuses half folded, which refers to bound feet, you know, seen as beautiful then. Right, a specific cultural marker.
Yeah, fingers like spring bamboo shoots, a round powdered face like a silver basin, and lips like slippery cherries. The text even says she's prettier than Chanji, the moon goddess. Even more pleasing.
And what's fascinating here is how much the story emphasizes her beauty, her allure. She's not just a monster. She's presented as genuinely captivating, seductive. That makes her a much trickier opponent, especially for someone like Tang Sanzang. Adds temptation to the danger.
A whole different kind of threat. And then Wukong overhears her plan. She's all happy ordering her servants to prepare a vegetarian banquet. Why? Because she intends to marry Tang Sanzang, like, right away. Tonight, share a bed with him.
Marry him. Just like that.
Just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wukong, the fly on the wall, is apparently pretty amused, finds the whole wedding idea kind of ridiculous.
What's that? Bit of shock.
So Wukong zips off and finds his master. Tang Sanzang's in this room with red paper lattice work, looking understandably pretty upset.
As you would be.
And Wukong, being Wukong, can't resist teasing him a bit.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, master, heard the good news. She wants to marry you.
Yeah.
Even jokes about them having a son or daughter. You know, amongst descendant.
Oh, Wukong. Always pushing buttons.
Always. But Tang Sanzang, he is not amused, not even slightly. The text says he's literally biting his teeth.
Yeah.
And he swears, absolutely swears, that if he loses his true yang, meaning if he breaks his vow of celibacy, he'll fall in endless reincarnation. He'll be trapped in the Yin Mountain forever.
And this is crucial, isn't it? This raises the important question. Why is his true yang, his celibacy, so absolutely central? It's not just about, you know, a physical rule. It represents his purity, his dedication, the entire spiritual integrity of his journey to get the scriptures. Losing it isn't just failure. For him, it's eternal damnation. Falling into Yin Mountain, that's the terrifying prospect in this cosmology. Profound spiritual state.
Exactly. It's everything to him. So the stakes are incredibly high. And Wukong realizes drastic measures are needed. He comes up with this. Well, audacious doesn't even cover it. It's Paul Plan. Forget trying to carry Tang Sanzang up that vertical tunnel. Seems impossible. Instead, Wukong tells him, okay, master, when she offers you that celebratory wine, drink it.
Drink the wine. Why?
Because. And here are the, let's say, gruesome specifics. Wukong plans to transform again, this time into a burnt melon beetle. It seems like a tiny, tough little bug. He'll hide in the joyful froth on top of the wine. She drinks it, swallows him.
Uh-oh. I see where this is going.
Yep. And once inside, Wukong plans to, quote, tear her heart and liver, sever her lungs, basically kill her from the inside out.
Wow. Okay. That is extreme.
Right.
What's fascinating here is just how extreme it is. It's pure Wukong pragmatism, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ruthless. Use any means necessary. It's such a stark contrast to Tang Sanzang's whole philosophy, his compassion, his nonviolence. And then Wukong suggests this. Really makes you think about ends justifying means.
And Tang Sanzang's reaction is exactly what you'd expect. He's horrified. This is not humane, he cries out.
Of course. Goes against everything he stands for.
But Wukong just shoots back, totally blunt.
Yeah.
Master, if you only worry about doing good deeds, your life is over right now. This demon harms people. Why are you feeling sorry for her?
Oof. Harsh reality check from Wukong.
Totally. And in the end, Tang Sanzang gives in. Reluctantly. His only condition is Wukong has to stay right there with him through it all. The text really highlights his internal conflict. There's a saying, basically, opening one's mouth dissipates spirit, moving one's tongue creates trouble.
Yeah.
But if he stays silent, he's afraid she'll just kill him. So it's this awful dilemma.
A real bind.
Totally. When he finally forces himself to respond, it's described as feeling like losing 1,000 pounds of flesh.
Right.
Just agonizing for him.
I could almost feel that weight. And while he's going through that, she's laying on the charm.
Oh, absolutely.
The text says, 1,000 coquetries, 10,000 charms. She's right there, holding his hand, leaning in close, whispering.
Mm-hmm. Head-to-head whispers. Very intimate. Very calculated.
But inside, he's just a heart full of worry. And they even describe her looks in detail, the willow leaf eyebrows, peach blossom face, fancy shoes, elaborate hair.
Right, that contrast is key. Her stunning appearance versus his internal misery. It really throws his spiritual focus into sharp relief.
So, okay, the charm offensive isn't quite working. What's her next move?
Plan B, a banquet.
Yeah.
A big feast to try and win him over.
But Tang Sanzang, being who he is, immediately says no to any meat or animal stuff, sticking to his vows.
Yeah, but she's ready for that. Super cunningly, she claims she has prepared a vegetarian feast using, get this, pure water from where yin and yang meet. It sounds respectful, but it's all part of the deception.
Wow. Pure water where yin and yang meet. That sounds mystical.
Exactly. It's designed to sound profound and accommodating to lower his guard.
And the food itself, was it actually vegetarian?
Oh, yeah. The spread was incredible, according to the text. A huge...
Like what? Give us some examples.
Okay. Tons of fruit. Mm. Apples, olives, lotus seeds, grapes, lychees, longans, chestnuts, walnuts, oranges. The list goes on.
Just a mountain of fruit.
And the vegetable dishes were just as elaborate. Tofu, gluten, mushrooms, bamboo shoots, all kinds of things.
Prepared fancy too, right? I remember reading some creative names.
That's right. Things like skinned eggplant made like quail and seedless winter melon named after a famous general. Real effort went into making it seem legitimate and impressive.
Okay, so an amazing vegetarian feast is laid out. Looks like she's respecting his rules, but you said it was a trap.
The food itself wasn't the main trap. Not really. It was the lead up. The real test comes next. She offers him the wine for union, holds it out with her pointed jade fingers. That's the moment of truth.
Ah, the wine. Of course. What does he do? He can't drink that.
He absolutely can't. And this bit is powerful. He takes the cup.
Yeah.
And pours the wine straight onto the ground while silently praying.
Crying to who?
He calls on all the guardian deities, basically all the divine protectors he can think of. He's begging them to help him not break his vows, to save him from eternal suffering and reincarnation.
Wow. So it's not just about avoiding marriage, it's about his soul's journey.
Precisely. Even facing death, his spiritual commitment is absolute. It's quite profound.
But then, doesn't Sun Wukong get involved somehow, his disciple?
Ah, yes. Wukong, ever the trickster, makes his move. Unseen, of course.
What does he do?
He transforms himself into a tiny bug, like a little woodworm. And knowing his master actually doesn't mind grape-based vegetarian wine, oh dear, he subtly tells Tang Sanzang to go ahead and drink this wine. Not exactly break the core vow, it seems more like a tactical move. Wukong's plan is clever. He intends to hide inside a yi, a flower of joy that magically appears in the cup when Tang Sanzang offers it back to the demon.
Ah, okay. So the plan is for the demon to drink Wukong.
That seems to be the idea. Get inside, cause trouble from within. Classic Wukong.
So does it work? Does she drink it?
Well, there's a delay. The demon is busy being, hey, all delicate and coy, sweet-talking Tang Sanzang, bowing. She doesn't drink right away.
Giving Wukong a bit more time, maybe?
Perhaps. But when she finally does raise the cup, poof, the flower disappears, revealing the tiny bug.
Oh, busted. What does she do?
Here's the interesting part. She just flicks it away, dismisses it as some random insect. She has no idea it's Sun Wukong, completely oblivious.
Wow. So close. Wukong must have been furious.
Or at least quick to adapt. Plan A failed. So instantly, he pivots.
Wow.
That tiny bug. It suddenly transforms into a massive, A hungry eagle.
It's an eagle inside the cave.
A terrifying one, described with jade claws, golden eyes, iron feathers, a truly heroic posture, fierce spirit soaring through clouds. Pure intimidation factor.
What does the eagle do?
Causes absolute mayhem. It swoops down, flips the entire banquet table, smashes everything, all those fruits, vegetables, dishes, everything. Total destruction.
Whoa. Okay, that's one way to break up a party. Classic Wukong indeed. Chaotic, but effective.
Exactly. It completely shatters the mood, to say the least.
I bet. How did they react? The demon and Tang Son's egg.
Pure terror. The demon's heart and guts split apart, the text says. And Tang Sanzang felt his bones and flesh go numb, just utter shock and fear.
Understandable. A giant, angry eagle suddenly trashing the place.
But here's where it gets fascinating psychologically. The demon doesn't think, oh, that must be his disciple intervening.
No. What does she think?
She interprets it as a divine sign. She thinks heaven and earth disapprove of her capturing Tang Sanzang.
Huh. So she completely misreads the situation, sees cosmic judgment instead of, well, Wukong being Wukong.
Right. It's a kind of self-deception, maybe. It allows her to perhaps feel cosmically significant, even in failure, rather than just outsmarted.
So does this scare her off? Does she let him go?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But no. Her resolve is, frankly, terrifyingly strong.
Seriously?
After all that...
Dead serious. She immediately tells her underlings, clean this mess up. Get more wine and food.
No way.
Yes. And this time, she says, forget vegetarian, bring whatever. She fully intends to go through with the marriage right then and there, using the heavens and earth as witnesses. Unbelievable. So the eagle gambit didn't actually free him.
It created chaos. It revealed her true colors, maybe, but it didn't break her will.
Oh.
Tang Sensang is escorted back to the East Corridor, still a captive.
His fate's still hanging in the balance. Wow.
Exactly. The danger is far from over. It just resets the scene, in a way. Wukong, he turned into an eagle, scouted things out, and now he's back in his own form at the cave entrance.
Right.
He shouts for the door, and out come Pigsy Zhu, Baji, and Sandy, Shao Wujing. And Pigsy, well, he's Pigsy.
Whatever the character.
Exactly. He immediately nudges Sandy, like, hey, brothers, here. They drop their weapons. Pigsy runs over, grabs Wukong, asking, is there a demon? Is Master okay?
And Wukong says, yeah, yeah, he's in there.
Mm-hmm. And Piggy's still kind of joking around, asks if Master's being, you know, tortured, tied up, steamed, boiled, the usual stuff.
The usual demon threats, yeah.
Like, Wukong quickly shuts that down. He says, no, that sort of thing. They're preparing a plain feast to do that thing with him.
That thing.
And,
all right.
And Pigsy, he still doesn't quite get it. He laughs and says, oh, you're lucky. You got to eat the wedding feast.
He thinks it's an actual wedding feast. Oh, dear.
Right. But Wukong immediately corrects him. There's no wedding feast for me. And actually, Master's life is in real danger because, well, she must get married to him.
Wow. Okay, that's a huge shift, isn't it? We're so used to demons wanting to, you know, eat Tang Sanzang for immortality.
Exactly.
But this is different. What makes this forced marriage, this intention Wukong mentions, to force intercourse in broad daylight, what makes that so dangerous for the monk?
Well, that's really the core of it here. For someone like Tang Sanzang, a devout monk, his vows of celibacy, his spiritual purity, they're absolutely central to the quest.
Mm.
So this kind of threat, it's arguably much worse for him than just being eaten. It's not just physical danger. It's an attack on his spirit, his vows, the whole point of his journey.
It undermines everything.
Precisely. The demoness isn't just after power like immortality. She wants to corrupt him, to break the spiritual foundation of his quest. When Wukong calls her shameless, it really underlines how transgressive her desire is in this context.
Absolutely. Okay, so the stakes are incredibly high now. Wukong needs a plan. He goes back into the cave, but this time he transforms into what? A tiny fly.
Yeah, little fly. Very clever. He lands up on the gatehouse, listening in.
Kiki.
Very. And he overhears the demoness, apparently furious, ordering her minions around. They need to prepare offerings because, as she declares, heaven and earth are to be the matchmakers.
Wow, she's really going through with this forced ceremony.
She is. And then Wukong, still as a fly, busses into the East Corridor. And that's where he finds Tang Sanzang. And the description is quite moving. Crying, tears streaming down his cheeks. He's utterly distraught.
Which is interesting because Tang Sanzang usually keeps it together, even when facing monsters. Why so emotional here? Is it just fear?
I think it's more complex than just fear. You see, when Wukong, still a fly, lands on his head and whispers, Tang Sanzang recognizes the voice. And he leaps up, apparently gritting his teeth, and he just lets Wukong have it.
Yeah.
He accuses Wukong of having guts wrapped around his body, kind of an idiom for being reckless and using his powers to break up households.
So he blames Wukong.
Directly. He blames Wukong for, quote, stirring up the demoness's lust.
Yep.
And basically causing this whole mess. So his tears seem to be a mix of fear, helplessness, and, well, sheer fury at his own disciple.
That's quite a reaction. How does Wukong respond to that?
Well, Wukong, ever the pragmatist, right, he whispers an apology, acknowledges the master's anger, but immediately says, Master, don't worry, don't be angry. I have a way. There's a way to save you.
Okay, the plan. Teng Sanzang must be desperate to hear it.
He asks how. Yes. And Wukong reveals this pretty ingenious strategy. He tells the monk that when he flew out earlier as that eagle, he spotted a garden behind the cave.
That garden.
The first step is the monk has to somehow trick the demoness into going to this garden with him.
All right. And then what? This is where it gets clever, I imagine.
Oh, definitely. This is where Wukong's tactical mind really comes into play. Teng Sanzang asks him, you know, why don't you just fight her? Just beat her up.
The direct approach. Seems like Wukong's style sometimes.
Sometimes, yes. But Wukong explains, look, this cave, it's got difficult entry and exit. The paths are narrow and curved. If they start a fight inside, they'll likely get trapped by the whole nest of demons living there.
Ah, okay. So a frontal assault is too risky.
Exactly. It could end badly for everyone.
Mm.
So Wukong says this trick, this, well, rather invasive plan, is the only clean way to handle it. To ensure success and their escape.
It's about exploiting the situation, not brute force.
Precisely. It's turning her desire, her perceived strength, into her fatal weakness. It's quite brilliant, really. And Teng Sanzang, hearing the logic, agrees. He'll cooperate.
Okay, so lay out this peach trick for us. It sounds wild.
It is pretty audacious.
Yeah.
So step one, get the demoness to the garden. Step two, Wukong will secretly fly ahead, land on a peach tree, and transform himself into a perfect ripe red peach.
He becomes a peach. Okay.
Step three. Teng Sanzang has to pretend he suddenly feels faint, or maybe just wants some fruit. He needs to point out that specific red peach, the Wukong peach.
Right.
And then, step four, the crucial part. He has to insist that the demoness picks that peach and eats it.
She has to eat Wukong disguised as a peach.
Exactly. And once she swallows him, Wukong declares he will basically wreak havoc from the inside. His words are quite graphic. Destroy her skin bag, tear out her liver and intestines, kill her.
Good grief. That's intense. A Trojan horse, but ingested?
Yeah, it's a biological Trojan horse, yeah. It's gruesome, but from Wukong's perspective, it's the most efficient, lowest risk way to neutralize the main threat without getting bogged down fighting minions in a bad location.
All right. The plan is set. Teng Sanzang, presumably stealing himself, has to now act his part.
Yes, and he does. He calls out to the demoness, putting on this weak voice. He claims he caught a heavy cold back at some temple, Zenhai Temple, and says he needs a walk to clear his mind, maybe in the garden.
Smooth. How does she react?
Oh, she's completely fooled. Absolutely delighted. She calls him my wonderful man brother, quite possessive, and immediately agrees. Of course, let's go to the garden.
She's buying it completely.
Hook, line, and sinker. She even orders her minions. Get this description. They're called oily-faced and powdered-faced, graceful and charming, to go prepare the garden for their stroll.
So even the minions are described in this sort of strangely alluring way.
It seems so. The whole atmosphere is shifting. So imagine the scene now. Teng Sanzang walking hand in hand with this demoness who intends to force herself on him.
Uh-huh.
Escorted by this flock of oddly charming little demons, and they're entering this garden, and the text just explodes with descriptions of its beauty.
Despite the horror of the situation.
Exactly. It talks about winding paths full of moss, elegant embroidered windows. There are descriptions of sun-kissed apricots, red like immortals drying robes, and moonlit plantains, green like a Taoist beauty's feather fan. Really evocative stuff.
Wow. It paints quite a picture. It does. There are even specific pavilions mentioned, with names like Condensing Fragrance Pavilion, Green Moth Pavilion, Sobering Pavilion, and even Lovesick Pavilion, complete with crimson curtains and fancy hooks.
Lovesick Pavilion. Oh, the irony.
Right. And ponds named Crane Bathing Pond and Goblet Washing Pond, full of duckweed and algae, but also shining with golden fish scales. The text explicitly compares the garden's beauty to mythical places like Penglai, the Taoist fairyland.
And the flowers, too, you mentioned.
Yes, compared to the most famous and prized peonies like Yao Huang and Wei Zi, symbols of ultimate floral beauty and luxury in Chinese culture.
So what are we meant to take from this? This incredibly beautiful, almost seductive setting for such a dangerous, frankly terrifying moment.
Well, I think that's the crux of it. The story presents this stark paradox. Tang Sanzang is in mortal danger, about to enact this really grim plan involving, you know, internal destruction.
Yeah.
And yet he's surrounded by overwhelming, almost intoxicating beauty and sensuality. It's not a dank, dark, typical demon lair. It's paradise.
So the beauty itself is a kind of test.
That's exactly how the text frames it. It says, and this is a key line, "Good monk, he was unaffected in this brocade array, deaf and mute among the embroideries. It praises him."
Well, so he's not swayed by it at all.
Not at all. It continues, "If not for this iron heart set on going to Buddha, a second mortal man of wine and lust would not have obtained the scriptures."
An iron heart. That says it all.
It really does. It emphasizes his incredible resolve. It suggests that his commitment isn't just about resisting ugly monsters or overt threats. It's also about maintaining focus, that iron heart, amidst overwhelming beauty, amidst subtle temptations, amidst things that might distract or allure a lesser person. His spiritual focus remains absolute, even here. Tang Monk is, he's basically a captive, but the demoness is leading him on a tour.
Yeah, a tour of her garden right there inside this cave. And it's described as, you know, quite beautiful, exotic flowers, pavilions, plants, leading eventually to a grove of peach trees.
Seems a bit odd for a demon's lair, doesn't it? Kind of. Nice.
Well, that's likely the point. It's probably meant to be disarming, you know, part of her attempt to charm Tang Monk, maybe lower his guard. It sets the scene perfectly for the unexpected.
And the unexpected definitely happens, because as they get near these peach trees, Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, makes his move.
A very subtle one at first.
Right, he just pinches Tang Monk's head, like a quick signal only the master would get.
Mm-hmm.
And then poof, Wukong transforms. But not into something obvious like a fly or whatever.
Ditto, he becomes a peach, a perfectly ripe red peach, just hanging there on a branch. Blending right in.
Incredible camouflage. He's basically hiding in plain sight.
Exactly. A Trojan peach, you could say. Right under her nose.
So Tang Monk, he gets the signal, obviously. And he plays along beautifully. Starts talking to the demoness, acting all innocent.
Feigning ignorance.
Totally. Yeah. He points at the tree and says something like, "My lady, how come these peaches aren't all ripe together? Some are red, some green. Why's that?"
Such a simple question. Almost childish, you might think.
It's a setup, isn't it? A really clever one.
It really is. Because her answer is, well, it's not what you'd expect from a man-eating demoness.
Right. Instead of just brushing it off, she gives this surprisingly profound explanation based on yin and yang.
Precisely. She gets quite philosophical.
What does she actually say? I remember being struck by that.
She explains it quite clearly. She says something like, "Heaven needs yin and yang for the sun and moon to be bright. The earth needs yin and yang for plants to grow."
Okay.
"And people need yin and yang to distinguish male and female." Then she connects it to the peaches.
How so?
She says, basically, the peaches that get the sun ripen first, so they turn red. The ones in the shade stay green. That's just the principle of yin yang.
Wow. That's quite articulate for someone holding a monk captive.
It is, isn't it? It adds this strange layer to her. Is she genuinely knowledgeable? Or is she just using this wisdom to appear, you know, more sophisticated or benevolent?
Hard to tell. And Tang Monk, he just eats it up, right?
Yeah.
Beelzo, thanks, sir.
Thank you, my lady. Truly, I didn't know this. Playing his part perfectly.
It does make you wonder, though, this wisdom coming from her.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a distraction. It kind of complicates her character, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It shows the author isn't just painting a simple villain. She has these facets. And crucially for the plan, it makes her feel superior, maybe a bit smug, and definitely lowers her guard.
Which is exactly what they need for the next step. The peach swap.
The switcheroo, yeah.
So Tang Monk reaches out and picks the red peach, mm-hmm. The one that's actually Wukong.
Mm-hmm.
And the demoness, maybe still basking in her philosophical moment, she picks a green one.
Yay.
And then Tang Monk, smooth as anything, offers the red one to her. Says something like, "You love color, my lady. You should have this one." And he takes the green one.
Genius move. And she completely falls for it. The text even gives us her inner thoughts.
Oh, yeah. What's she thinking?
Something like, "Wow, what a good monk. So genuine. We're not even married yet, and he's showing me such affection." She's apparently totally charmed. Starts showing him real respect.
You can almost feel the tension ratchet up. The plan is working perfectly.
Almost too perfectly.
And then, the moment of truth. She opens her mouth to take a bite of that lovely red peach.
And Wukong,
ever impatient, doesn't even wait for the bite. He just tumbles down her throat. Mm. The text uses this great phrase, like a somersault straight down.
Right into her stomach? Oh, man.
The reaction is immediate. Confusion. Fear. She cries out that the fruit was fierce because it went down without her even biting it.
And Tang Monk has to think fast, right?
Oh,
he starts making up these wild excuses.
Absolutely. Well, first, it's like, oh, the fruit just loved being eaten, so it went down quickly.
Okay. Plausible? Maybe.
Then she complains she didn't even spit the pit out, and he says, well, your beautiful intention and great love for it just made it slide right down, pit and all.
He's just scrambling, throwing anything out there.
Pretty much, but then Wukong blows his cover.
From the inside.
Yep. He shouts out, Master, stop arguing. Old Sun has succeeded. Game over for the deception.
Oh, the look on her face must have been something. Tang Monk then has to deliver the news.
He does. Just tells her straight, my disciple, Sun Wukong, is inside you. He was the red peach.
And she just panics.
Complete panic. This monkey is in my belly. I'm going to die.
She demands to know what Wukong plans to do.
And Wukong doesn't exactly reassure her, does he?
Not even slightly. He gives this absolutely terrifying, gruesome threat.
What does he say? Remind us.
He basically says he's going to eat her insides. He lists her liver, lungs, heart.
Uh-huh.
Says he'll wash her organs clean and turn her into a drum.
Yikes. Pure psychological warfare. Maximum terror.
Exactly. It's designed to break her will completely. But then, the story throws another curveball. Instead of just collapsing in terror, she does something unexpected.
Right. She clings to Tang Monk and starts reciting poetry.
Poetry. Seriously. Now.
Yeah, this really sorrowful poem, lamenting their fate, comparing them to separated lovers like mandarin ducks or phoenixes. She talks about their joyful meeting being empty, wonders when she'll see him again. It's quite dramatic.
That's bizarre. A demoness reciting breakup poetry while a monkey plans to rearrange her organs from the inside.
It really underscores her complexity again, doesn't it? Even in her monstrosity, there's this echo of something else, maybe longing, maybe just manipulation again.
But Wukong isn't buying it, is he?
Not for a second. He's probably worried Tang Monk's soft heart might actually be swayed by this performance.
So Wukong decides to escalate things.
Drastically. From inside her stomach, he starts doing martial arts. The text says he's wheeling his fists and jumping his feet, basically beating her up from the inside out, almost bursting her stomach, it says.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would refocus the attention.
Definitely. She collapses in agony, can barely speak. Pain compliance, pure and simple.
So that's it then. She has to give in.
She has no choice. The pain is too much. She manages to call for her servants, the little demons.
Who are probably just hanging out, playing games or something.
Exactly. They rush in, totally clueless.
Like she tells them.
Yeah.
What? Get this monk out of here.
Pretty much. There's someone in my belly. Hurry, send this monk out. Save my life.
So the little demons try to grab Tang Monk.
They start to, yeah. But Wukong shouts from inside again. Another ultimatum.
Directed at them this time?
Yep. Nobody touches him. You send my master out yourselves. Get him outside and I'll spare your lives. He makes it clear. Only her cooperation personally will save her.
Wow. So she has to carry him out herself.
That's the final humiliation and her only option. She values her life more than her pride or Tang Monk. So she struggles up, gets Tang Monk on her back, and starts running for the cave entrance.
Carrying the guy she kidnapped? Because his disciple is currently pummeling her spleen.
Pretty much sums it up. And when her little demons ask where she's going, she even quotes a proverb.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Something like, as long as the bright moon of the five lakes remains, why worry about finding no place to cast a golden hook? Basically meaning...
there are other fish in the sea.
Exactly. Send this fellow out. Let me find another partner. She's cutting her losses, focusing on survival. Surprisingly pragmatic, even defiant.
Amazing. And as they get to the cave mouth...
they hear fighting, clanging sounds. Ding, ding, dang, day.
Pigsy and Sha Wujing.
Tang Monk recognizes the sound of Pigsy's rake immediately. He yells out, Pigsy.
And Pigsy hears him.
Loud and clear. Shouts back, Sha Wujing, master's out. And the two of them basically clear a path as the demoness carries Tang Monk out to freedom.
What a rescue. Perfectly coordinated.
And the chapter ends with this great poetic couplet summing it all up. Heart Ape responds from within to subdue the evil monster, earth and wood, guard the gate to receive the holy monk.
Heart Ape being Wukong.
Right, the restless mind, the cleverness inside. And earth and wood are Pigsy and Sha Wujing, the loyal protectors at the gate.